explained to me what was going on. It said that the Caucasian clause was prohibiting him from making a better living than he was making because he wasn't allowed to play in a lot of tournaments because of his skin color.
Welcome to Out the Trap, a podcast that's all about black folks and the game of golf. Tune in every Monday as I talk with black folks from all walks of life who are passionate about this crazy game. His stories from the weekend golfer to the innovators of black-owned golf companies and everyone in between. My name is Anthony McNeil, certified golf junkie and your host. Let's get ready to tee off. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode number 10 of Out the Trap. Once again, it's me, your boy, Anthony McNeil. Guys, I have a very special guest joining me on the podcast today. But before I get to my special guest, I would like to take a moment and just say rest in peace to a legend that we lost as far as black golfers go. And that's Mr. Lee Elder, who passed away a few days prior to this recording being made. And just want to give condolences and prayers to his family. And the man made a big impact in the game as far as black golfers go. You know, he was the first black to play in the Masters. And, you know, people like Tiger Woods has followed in his footsteps, of course. But he's just one of many of our black heroes that has played this game. And he's no longer here with us. And just want to say rest in heaven, Mr. Elders. And speaking of legends, my guest today joining me on the podcast, he's the son of the Jackie Robinson of golf. If you are in the game of golf, if you are a historian, if you are a black person that plays this game, I'm sure you are familiar with the name of Dr. Charlie Sifford. I am honored to have joining me today on the podcast, Charlie Sifford Jr. Charlie, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, I can. How you doing this morning?
I'm doing fantastic, sir. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to come on the podcast and share some thoughts and educate those that don't know about your dad. For those that don't know, let me tell you a little bit about who Charlie Sifford was. As I said, Charlie Sifford is what I call the Jackie Robinson of golf. And this gentleman was the first black to play in a licensed PGA event. He broke that clause that the PGA had that did not allow us to play on their tour. And Mr. Sifford was the first to break through and do that. And as I was saying, Mr. Sifford, he was the first African-American to play on the PGA. There was a clause, as you all know, that prohibited us from participating on the PGA. And 1961, Mr. Sifford was the first black card-holding member of the PGA. And this gentleman, he won 6 Negro National Open titles. He's honored as one of the top 100 people in the first century of golf. He was among the top 60 money winners on the PGA Tour throughout the 1960s. He won more than $1.2 million on the PGA Tour and the Senior Tour. He was the first black golfer to be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in the class of 2004. He was awarded the honorary doctorate degree from the University of St. Andrews in 2006. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama in 2014. And one of my favorites, Tiger Woods, his son was named after Mr. Sifford. So this man has made quite the impact, and I am honored to have his son joining me here on the podcast. What's one of the earliest memories you have of your dad playing golf?
Well, it was probably around when I was about 6 or 7 years old. It was like, what, 50s, early 50s, where, you know, golf wasn't on TV like baseball and football and basketball were.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was he was on tour playing the game of golf, and I didn't really know what golf was because I never really saw anybody play at that early age.
Uh-huh.
But then my mom was always telling me that's what he was doing, you know, playing a professional, making a living to provide for his family.
Yeah. Do you know how your dad got introduced to the game?
Yeah, he started, from Charlotte, North Carolina. As a teenager, you know, there wasn't many jobs available. He lived near a golf course, and he went to North Carolina Country Club and got a job as a caddy. He worked there for a number of years. And by the time, you know, playing a little bit when he could, by the time he was like 13 years old, he was able to shoot par around the golf course.
Wow.
And beat a lot of the members that were in the club. He started caddying, and a majority of the young black kids back in the day, that's how they got exposed to the game.
Did you ever get into the game yourself, you or any of your siblings?
We played, my brother and I played golf. Dad didn't force it on us. He let us decide what we wanted to do, and whatever we decided to do, he wanted us to be the best that we could be.
Mm-hmm.
I was more interested in baseball, and my brother, he's a few years younger than I am, but his main interest was football. We both played the game, you know, to satisfy our dad, because we knew that he wanted us to play.
Yeah.
But he understood that we didn't have the passion for the game that he had. And that's what you need to be successful at this game at that higher level.
That's for sure. How old were you when you realized that your dad was a big deal? I mean, what he managed to accomplish by being the first black to play on the PGA Tour as a licensed member. Do you remember how old you were when you realized the impact that this man was making?
Yes, I was 61. I was in junior high school.
Okay.
So 13, 14 years old, you know, reporters on TV was talking about him, and they started showing highlights of different golf tournaments more than they did in the past. So, you know, that's when I really realized what he was doing. Made me proud that he was fighting for the right to play the game.
You mm-hmm.
know, for him, not only just for himself, but all minorities around the country.
Did you understand the importance of what he was doing at that time, or did you know that he was just playing a game that he loved?
I just knew he was playing a game, and that there weren't many blacks playing the game, and he was just trying to open up the opportunities. I had no idea about the racial discrimination thing until the lawsuit was filed. You know, my mom and dad sat me down and explained to me what was going on. They said that the Caucasian clause was prohibiting him from making a better living than he was making, because he wasn't allowed to play in a lot of tournaments because of his skin color.
Mm-hmm. Did you and your family, did you all have the opportunity to travel with your dad at all?
Not on the regular tour. Most of my traveling when I was younger was done with the UGA, United Golf Association, which was, you know, the black tour at the time. We were able to drive to certain cities when Dad was playing. We would go to the tournament. He wasn't making enough money at the time I was growing up to be able to take us on a regular tour, you know, travel the way the guys are traveling now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times the players travel 2-3 at in a car, just, you know, cut down on the expenses of going from one tournament to another. And it just wasn't enough money going around to bring your family with you. The only time I really got a chance to see him play was when he was playing locally. And I was basically, I saw him several times playing in the LA Open prior to his winning it, 67, 69.
Did you ever have an opportunity to caddy for him?
I caddied on the senior tour, you know, and once the senior tour started, I caddied, I'll probably say maybe about 10 tournaments, and we were fortunate enough to win 7 of them. I would like to say because of my great caddy, but it was because of his ability to play the game.
I'm sure you helped him read a couple of them greens that.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes he took my advice. Sometimes he did, sometimes he didn't. But it was a good time, and it was an opportunity for us to find more, because when I was younger, didn't really get a chance to spend a lot of time with
him. That's what I was going to say. That had to be quite the experience. I mean, just to spend that time, you know, I remember being younger and, you know, my dad never played the game, but, you know, his thing was fishing. And I just remember spending those days just out on the water with him all day long, just fishing and just a bonding. So to be able to, you know, to carry the bag for your dad like that, given all that he had gone through. And like you say, the time that he was away from the family, and just that bonding period, I'm sure that had to be quite the experience. Speaking of that, outside of golf, what's your favorite memory of your dad?
Well, there was really a lot. You know, when he was at home, he was always there making sure he did spend time with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would take me to the driving range and show me how to hit golf balls. Occasionally, we went to a baseball game. He knew quite a few of the Los Angeles Dodgers. which he had met, you know, a lot of them when they were originally from Brooklyn, when they moved to L.A. around the same time that we did. So we had a chance to go spend some time at the ballpark, you know, spend some father son time together.
Yeah, that's great, man. Now, your dad, I'm sure back then, to accomplish what he accomplished, he had to have gone through quite a bit. During those times, we all know what was going on in the country as far as the racial tension and all that stuff. And I mean, again, we're talking about back in the early 60s. I mean, he was right at the height of it. And was there a moment that you're aware of where he ever just wanted to say to hell with it, this ain't worth it, and just throw in the towel?
Yeah, it was several times he came home after a bad tournament or someone that said something to him to get him upset. You know, and when he would hold all that in, he wouldn't express his anger in public. You know, he would hold it in, and when he got home, you could just tell that he was not in a good mood, but, you know, he wouldn't take it out on anybody. But my mom reminded him several times of his conversation with Jackie Robinson before he decided to attempt to go on the tour. And Jackie asked him, was he a quitter? And my father said no. And so Jackie said, that's good to hear, but there's going to be time when you're going to feel like you want to quit because of all the barriers that you're going to have to face. And once my mom, you know, brought that conversation up, you know, he would calm down and rejuvenate himself and go out and practice some more and work on his game and get better and hit the road again and show them that they weren't going to wear him down, that he was there to fight to the end.
Yeah. Man, that's, I just have to take my hat off to him because I don't think a lot of us nowadays are built for what he went through. I mean, to endure the hatred and the name calling and all that stuff and just risking your life just to play the game of golf. I shouldn't even say just play the game of golf, but to do something that you just love and you just want to do. It's just a game. And not to be able to do it at the highest level without all of the other things that came along with, you know, him doing what he did is mind boggling to me because I don't think many people could have withstood all that was thrown at him. I know I've read stories about some of the things that have gone on with the death threats and things like that, that he received, and to still show up and perform the way he performed. It was incredible. You had mentioned his conversation with Jackie Robinson. Were you present for that conversation?
No, I wasn't. No.
Okay.
That was, might not even been born, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
That was in the late 40s. I was born in 47, so it was around that era, that time when he was talking to Jackie. And that's what, you know, when he talked to him, but Jackie had a team behind him. You know, Dad was on his own. So, you know, it made a difference. Dad just had to be the right person at the right time to deal with what he had to deal with.
And, you know, I know this is a golf conversation and a golf podcast, but I just want the listener out there to know there are a lot of blacks like Mr. Siffert in our history. You look at people like Mr. Wendell Scott. A lot of people don't know that name, but Wendell Scott was the first black to race in NASCAR, and he was the first black to ever win a NASCAR race back in, I think it was 62. And just until recently, Mr. Scott was given his trophy for winning that race because they did not declare him the winner at the time because there were so many death threats towards the track owner for allowing him to race in the first place. And then once he finally won, there was no way they were going to give him the trophy because they would have burned that place down. So it wasn't until hours after the race that he was declared the winner. And his family recently just got that trophy that was awarded to a white driver at that time. So men like Mr. Scott and Dr. Siffert, there are so many stories like that. You know, we all are familiar with basketball and football and boxing and things like that. But we as black people have made history in so many other sports that I encourage you to go out and research and look up some of the information, especially about some of the things that Mr. Siffert went through, because, again, it's incredible when you really think about it. Just to want to play a game of golf, your life is being threatened.
I mean, to me, nowadays, that's just crazy. But to not give up and to go out and pursue your passion, you know, in possibly losing your life, that says a lot about the man and his determination. To see your father accomplish what he did, was there any pressure or expectations on you or your siblings to follow in his footsteps or just to live up to the Siffert name?
No, there was no outside pressure. You know, people thought just because our names were Siffert that we were automatically good golfers. You know, it takes talent, determination, practice, and a love for the game. It's not something that I don't believe it can be passed down from bloodline. It's something that you have to really want to do. I didn't want to play because I saw and heard about all the things that my father had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And even at a young age, I know I couldn't have done it.
Yeah.
So I didn't develop that love for the game. I liked the game. You know, it was interesting to me because my dad played it. But my first love was always baseball.
Okay.
And there was even less pressure on my brother. So my father just didn't force either one of us.
Even though your dad didn't pressure you guys to play, was there ever a point where you or your brother felt like you had to at least attempt playing the game because you were a Siffert?
You know, I played high school golf. I played college golf, but I played because it was fun. But to me, I just didn't want to put a lifetime of practicing and all that. And I just wasn't that interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I enjoyed the game. I liked to play it, but it wasn't something I really wanted to do based on my early experiences, you know, behind what my father had to do. So, I didn't put any pressure on myself. I played it, you know, and I still play. You know, I had my good days and my bad days.
But, we all do. You know,
yeah, so I never, you know, all I wanted to do was just try to play the best I could. That wasn't good enough. It just wasn't good enough. And I didn't, you know, it wasn't any pressure on me
mm-hmm.
from within me that I had to be as good as he was.
Yeah. I want to go back for a second. You said you were, what, 6 or 7 when he got his PGA card?
No, 61. See, I was 14.
Okay. Do you recall that day? What exactly happened that day? How it all went down?
All I knew was that, you know, he was going back and forth talking to Attorney General Moss of California, and he was spent a lot of time at the Capitol. I wasn't there. They told me and my mom that my father was in Sacramento with Stanley Moss, and they were filing a lawsuit against the PGA, advising them that they could not hold any tournaments at all in California. So they struck down the Caucasian Hunting Clause. And next thing we heard, we were told that the clause was eliminated. And Dad was awarded a temporary membership into the PGA later on in the year 61. And he got his full card in 62. And all that was done by the mail. There was no one that actually came to the house or anything like that and presented his card. They just mailed it to him.
Do you remember the first tournament that he played in once he got his card?
No, it was a tournament down in the South, but I don't recall which one.
Okay. And when he first got on the tour, and he finally started making some money. Do you remember how that made him feel to finally feel like he was getting his due worth for all the sacrifice that he had put in? Do you recall when he made that first money on the PGA? Do you recall how that made him feel?
It made him feel good. You know, he started making enough money where he can, you know, really maintain and take care of his family the way he wanted to. He had saved up enough money to go buy him a new car. And, you know, he purchased some property in California. And so he was more relaxed and more comfortable playing the game because he knew that he had more opportunity to play.
Mm-hmm.
Although in some areas, I don't know, I think a lot of people don't know that most of the tournaments were open tournaments. But once they eliminated their Caucasian-only clause, they initiated invitationals. So most of the tournaments became invitationals. And so they still had control over who was going to play in the tournament, whether you had a PGA card or not. So he still didn't have full access to the tour, but he had more than he had prior to 61.
Do you recall when that all changed for him, when he did finally get full access to the tour? Do you recall when that happened?
Yeah, I think it was probably 64, 65, and then to the point where he got better, more confident, and then in 67 when he finally broke through and shot his, I think, 63 on the final day. At the time, was the Hartford Open, and he won that tournament in 67. And that gave him confidence to know that he was able to play with the big boys, and, you know, but then he won again in 69 in L.A., and at the time, we were living in L.A., so that was really a big bonus.
Now, you mentioned the big boys. Back then, you had the Palmers and the Nicholas and, right, and all of them. How was he accepted by them?
Most of the players, I would say, he didn't name all of them, but most of the players accepted him. You know, there was a few that didn't like him to be out there. Gary Player was probably his best friend out there. And he had Jackie Burke Sr. and Jr., Mr. Palmer, Mr. Nicholas, Sneed was a good friend of his. You know, a lot of the players, and there were several that really supported his effort because they saw what he was going through, you know, and it was really not too much they could do about it because, you know, the PGA was the main force behind the tour at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the players supported him real well.
That's good to hear. I'm happy to hear that because, you know, I know like in other sports, you know, you had a lot of the players didn't want us out there with them. So that's right. Good to hear. I want to fast forward a little bit. And, you know, your dad opened the doors, obviously, for people like Tiger to come along. How was his relationship with Tiger?
They got along real well. You know, the dad was, his playing career on the regular tour was over by the time Tiger was out there. Tiger would call him, he would call Tiger, and they'd talk about things. And whenever he was in the area near where Tiger was playing, he made it a point to go watch him play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talked before the round, after the round, had lunch together. They were real close.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Tiger?
I have never met him face to face. The first time I saw him, he was like 13 or 14 years old.
Okay.
Playing in the junior tournament down in Houston. And my father and I went to the tournament. And we walked 9 holes with him. And he hit some shots that you would not think a teenager know how to hit. You
know, I bet.
We just looked at each other and said, this kid is special. And, you know, some of the things he did with the golf club at that age is unbelievable.
Oh, man, I can only imagine. That had to have been something to see. Now, your dad passed in 2015, correct?
Correct.
And he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That was at 2014?
2014, yeah. I believe November.
And I'm sure that had to have meant the world to him to receive that medal from the first black president. Do you recall that day? Were you present that day?
Yeah, I was at his house. Someone from the White House had called me prior to, I would say maybe like 2 weeks prior, and we attend on awarding the medal to your father. And they asked me, do you think he would accept it? I said, I'm sure he will. And so they gave us a date that they were going to call his house. And I made sure I was there. I answered the phone. And they called, and I said, Dad, somebody on the phone want to speak to you. It was President Obama's assistant. And they told him who President Obama wanted to award him the Presidential Medal of Freedom Award, and they asked him, would he accept it? He said, hell yeah. So then he actually started crying.
I'm sure, man.
And so I got back on the phone, and I talked with them, and they, you know, they said, we'll be in touch with you with all the information as far as travel arrangements and all that stuff. And that was maybe a 10-minute conversation. And after I got off the phone, he was really excited. He said, I'm going to the White House. I got to go get me a new suit and a new pair of shoes.
Now, I'm sure he was quite emotional.
Oh, he was. He was emotional when he won the tournament, but this was a different kind of emotion.
Mm-hmm. When he got off the phone with the White House, what was the first thing he said? Do you remember?
Yeah, there was a statement about he was going to the White House.
Okay. Okay.
That was the first thing he said. I'm going to the White House. We got to go shopping. You know, I get some clothes.
I mean, that
man, that had to make him feel so good, given all that he had gone through for so many years. Yeah. That had to just be the highlight of his life. I can only imagine. And then, like I say, to receive it from the first black president, that couldn't have gotten any better.
Definitely special. Yeah, because he had met several other presidents prior to that, you know, at various golf tournaments. So, you know, it wasn't the first time that he had met a president. But it was special, you know, coming from Barack Obama.
Did you accompany him to the White House?
I went, my wife went, my brother and my daughter and grandson all went to the presentation.
What was that like, meeting the Obamas?
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, that was the first time I met someone that high in the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a black man, it was really something special. He was just, you know, just the nicest person you ever want to meet. We met Michelle, and they would talk to you just like you're an old family member, you know, calling each other by the first name and asking how you were doing, you know, just like you sit down in the living room, just having a conversation with old friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I got to ask, given that you got these two men that made history there together, before the cameras and everything got turned on, what's one story you can share of a conversation that took place that, unless you were in the room that day, you may not have had the privilege to hear? Is there anything that you can share, any behind the scenes type stuff that you can share that happened that day?
Yeah, you know, President Obama plays golf. He's left-handed.
Okay.
So he asked my father, you know, he said, I'm having a problem doing this, doing that. He said, anything you can do to help me? And he said, he called him Barack. He said, Barack, I don't know if I can help you or not, because you hit the ball from the wrong side. Right? He said, I do what I can. Because he always, you know, the left hand, and his mind played from the wrong side of the golf ball.
Right. Man, that I'm sure that's a memory you will hold on to forever.
Yeah, Barack started laughing. Vice was there. He's the vice president at the time, and both of them just started laughing.
Wow, that's quite a memory. For the listeners, if you go back and listen to episode number 6, I had Mr. Russ Crockett on the podcast, and he was telling me about the Charlie Sifford Centennial Celebration that's going to be taking place here in 2022. And that entails a lot of different things. I believe a cigar brand, a documentary, and some other things, a book, I believe, that's going to be coming out. Why did the family decide to get behind this celebration?
We knew his birthday was coming up. Would have been a special thing, 100 years old. And we wanted to do something so that my father's name would be out in the public and be recognized, you know, for many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know exactly how to do it. And Russell met my father in Houston. Him and my mom was living down there. And they got to be real close friends. Out of the clear blue, Russell called me in 2020, you know, and mentioned that, you know, Dad's birthday was coming up in 2022. And he had a group in Houston that was interested in doing some things to focus on creating more exposure to my father's name and wanted to know who would be interested. I said, sure, we'd be glad to work with you and, you know, get things together. So it was a no-brainer. We wanted to do it, but we didn't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell had the insight on how to do it, so it was a perfect match. And the things that he decided to do, we thought was a perfect match. You know, we have reissued his book, Just Let Me Play, with added stories and more pictures. We came up with the cigar line, and we're having a hat. It should be out in a couple more weeks with a hat, but the cigar is online now.
Okay.
And the book is online. So things are moving along. They're working on a documentary. Also, there's talk of a one-man stage show regarding my father that they're working on, too.
That sounds like it's going to be a great tribute to your dad. And again, for the listeners, if you go back and listen to episode number 6, you can get all the details about the celebration. And I'm going to put links to some of the things
regarding the celebration down in the show notes. So go learn a little bit more about the celebration that's going to be taking place, because there is quite a bit that's going to be going on. And I have to say, if you have not seen the packaging for the cigars, please click the link in the show notes and go over and check these out. These cigars were made by John Stark, who played in the NBA for the New York Knicks. His company is the one that put together the cigars, I believe. And the packaging on these things are beautiful. And I don't smoke cigars, but I plan on buying a pack just to keep, because the packaging on these things are incredible. So please go over and support and check that out. And again, there's going to be a link to that down in the show notes. Charlie, I want to be respectful of your time, and I just have one more question, or actually two more questions. Okay. I want to ask you. And my next question is there one thing you can share about your dad that most people may not know?
Yes, he had a great sense of humor. A lot of people didn't see that on the course, you know, because he was focused in on what he was doing. He had that, you know, that pre-Tiger Woods stare, tunnel vision. You know, with Tiger Woods, it was a stare and tunnel vision. What Dad was doing, and the people said he was angry and bitter.
Yeah,
but he just, that was just his way of concentrating on playing the game. But when he was at home, he was like a jokester. People would call the house and He would answer the phone like he was talking in a foreign language, act like he didn't understand what you were saying, and telling you had the wrong number and you know, things like that. And by the time you're getting ready to hang up, he started laughing. But, you know, he did that, you know, sometimes when he called some people, he would do the same thing. But, you know, when he was at home, he was relaxed and he just did a lot of joking. He liked to dance. Mm-hmm. And, when his great grandson was born, you couldn't get him to put the baby down. So he was a real sentimental person as well.
Yeah, yeah, man. Thanks for sharing that. That's awesome. Last question I want to ask you, Charlie, and this has to do with you yourself. What's the strongest part of your game?
My short game. Dad always told me that if you can chip and putt, you can compete with anybody, because everybody can hit the ball long, but if you can't get it in the hole, it's not going to do any good. He said, you're not going to hit 18 greens every time you play golf. Mm-hmm. So you got to be able to get the ball up and down and be able to make a putt when you had to. I didn't have an opportunity to hit balls all the time, but I had a backyard, and I would go out in the backyard and chip, you know, and I got to be pretty good at it. And I would say that chipping and putting is my strongest point. And then if I do get lucky enough to start hitting some greens, I do some damage to some people.
Well, you better than me, because that is definitely my weak point, my short game. Yeah, man. Listen, Charlie, I greatly appreciate you coming on and sharing, you know, the stories about your dad. And again, I'm looking forward to this centennial celebration and everything that's going to be going on. As a matter of fact, I'm going out to Pebble Beach in January with three of my buddies, and I need to make sure I have my cigars by then. So I'm going to be ordering up my pack here real soon so I can get those in time for my trip.
Okay. So, I appreciate that. It was a pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And likewise. And, you know, you guys take care of yourselves, and if there's anything I can ever do here at the podcast to help, you know, carry on your dad's name, feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to do my little part any way I can. Thank you to your dad for the sacrifices that he made so that, you know, this game can include more of us. And, you know, just happy holidays to you and your family, man. And I appreciate you taking time out of your day to come on and share these stories with me. Listen, you know what to do. Follow the podcast. Right now, the podcast is gaining ground. As of today, we are number 27 on the Apple Podcast Golfing Charts for the country of Canada. We're number 74 in the United States, behind the PGA Tour and iHeartRadio and Barstool Sports. So we're an independent podcast, and we are right up there with the big boys. I couldn't do it without you guys supporting the podcast. And my goal is to get this podcast to number one, because there are no other black podcasts out there for the game of golf. And I want to get this one to number one. but I need you guys' help. So that means you have to listen, you have to share, you have to follow the podcast and all those other things that they ask you to do on the platforms. And on that note, I'm out of here. You guys keep hitting them straight, and I will see you all on the next episode.